Andrew Michael Hurley's debut novel, The Loney, won the Costo Award for the Best First Novel and the British Book Industry Award for the Best Debut Fiction and Book of the Year. Set in the Yorkshire Dales, Starve Acre is Andrew's third novel. It's the story of a couple, Richard and Juliet Willoughby, whose five-year-old son, Ewan, has recently died. As the book unfolds, we learn that Ewan was a troubled young boy, and also that life for the Willoughbys in their country home near the Yorkshire Moors has been far from easy. I'm joined from London by the author of Starve Acre, Andrew Michael Hurley. Can we begin with the title Starve Acre? Such an evocative place name for the country home of the Willoughbys. Where did that name come from?
I came across the name when I was doing some research for my second novel, actually. And I was very interested in why particular places had acquired particular names. And so through the course of research, I looked at sort of lists of field names, and Starve Acre was one of those names that really sort of leapt out the page at me. I thought it's such an amazing name. And so it led me to think about what the story might be behind that, why it had acquired that particular appellation. And so partly the novel is really an imagined history of that place.
Because landscape has always been crucial in your fiction.
It has, yes. It's generally where I start from. The idea that I had when I started writing novels was to try and write about three places that hitherto hadn't been written about before. So kind of forgotten landscapes, I suppose, in the northwest of England. And so I've always started from place, really. So The Loney is set in Morecambe Bay. My second novel, Devil's Day, was set in the forest of Bowland in the east of Lancashire. And now Starve Acre is set on the borders of the Yorkshire Dales.
Now, the story revolves around Richard and Juliet Willoughby. Tell us a little about them and the harrowing experience they're after enduring as the book begins.
Well, we meet the Willoughbys about 6 months after their son Ewan has died. He's only 5 years old. He dies very suddenly. And in the novel, Richard and Juliet are pulling in completely opposite directions in the way that they deal with this grief. So Juliet believes very firmly that something of Ewan has remained in the house, some spirit or his ghost in some way. And so she spent a lot of time since the funeral trying to capture these moments of contact that she's had with him. So she's written things down in a notebook, and she's left a tape recorder running to see if she can catch his voice. And she's set up mirrors in his old bedroom to see if she can sort of catch a glimpse of his ghost. Richard is kind of pulling in the opposite direction. He's trying to be more practical. He's trying to at least get Juliet to think about having another child and filling the house with life and laughter again. But both of them are struggling, you know, and they don't really have a language with which to articulate what they're experiencing. And so this is the reason why they turn to the supernatural and the superstitious.
Yes, because it's all quite claustrophobic. It's a small country house and this Starve Acre, which is a field around the house.
Yes, it's claustrophobic for that exact reason. I really wanted to try and create a kind of pressure cooker environment where these people would be put under great amounts of stress, really, and just to sort of see what that made them do, really.
And the reader gets quite a jolt early on, courtesy of Richard, when he just mentions that Ewan wasn't vicious or cruel. And you think, he was 5 years old. How could this character be vicious or cruel?
Yeah, I wanted to try and write about a kind of very difficult relationship between parents and a child, and sort of go against the expectations that we might have of a child, that they are kind of innocent, and you know, we can sort of excuse a lot of the things that they do. And I think both Richard and Juliet are in denial about Ewan's real behaviour and what kind of person he really is for a great amount of the novel, actually. And one of the things that Juliet is trying to do more than anything is kind of ameliorate the image that the people in the village have of Ewan, because they think of him as being this really kind of violent little boy, and she's trying to change that image of him, but she never succeeds. She doesn't get the chance before unfortunately he passes away. So they're sort of stuck with this persona in their lives.
Starve Acre, the acre of land where the house where the Willoughbys live, is holding its own secrets. What can you tell us about the oak that used to grow in Starve Acre?
One of the things that Richard is looking for in the field are the roots of an old oak tree called the Stithwaite Oak. And it's this tree of sort of legendary size that used to grow there. And the story goes that it was struck down by God, it was poisoned in some way because it was once used for hanging. And so Richard starts to discover a little bit more about the history of this tree and the history of the village, and finds out through the woodcut prints that he finds in his father's study that three boys from the village had been hanged from this tree several hundred years before for various sort of despicable crimes that they'd committed. And the crimes that they blamed on a figure called Jack Gray, who's this sort of woodland spirit. And so Richard is partly trying to sort of piece together the history of those particular crimes.
Yes, and this kind of supernatural figure, Jack Gray, where does that
Yeah,
character come from?
he's sort of based on, as Richard says in the novel, based on other folklore characters like the Green Man or Robin Goodfellow. So an entity that on the one hand seems very kind of sort of mischievous, but on the other is actually quite sinister and dangerous as well. So, but he, Jack Gray, is only really a kind of personification of a bigger power that exists in this place, really, that no one can quite quantify, really. So Jack Gray is a way of explaining this sort of bigger elemental energy that seems to lie in the field.
Yes, like people say, look out for the boogeyman or
Yes.
whatever the frightening thing you say to children is. As you said, Juliet believes that there is some trace or presence of her dead son in the house and perhaps in the field. And she then makes contact with people who are open to the supernatural, whereas, as you say, Richard isn't. Tell us a little about the beacons. Who did you model them on?
The beacons, I suppose, are modelled on spiritualists, I guess. So Juliet enlists the help of a group of occultists called the Beacons via a friend of hers down in the village, and she invites them to the house with this idea that they're going to come there and somehow summon back Ewan's life force, his spirits, and in what form she doesn't really know, and I don't think she really minds as long as she feels as though Ewan's presence has sort of been returned to her. But it was an opportunity, really, to pick up on some of the themes that I was talking about in my first novel, The Loney, about faith, and particularly the reasons why people put their faith in religion or the supernatural, and actually whether those two things are part of the same thing.
Before the novel begins, you present us with an epigram detailing old folk names for the hare. What did inspire you that the hare becomes this kind of malign presence?
The poem at the start of the novel is based on a much older poem that I found in a book about hares, actually. So I sort of use the similar sort of format to that. But there is this hares loom large in huge amounts of folklore in Britain and in Ireland as well. And in fact, all over the world, there are kind of stories of hares because they are very sort of mysterious animals. And they are quite sort of tricksy as well. They're kind of mercurial, and they have different personas, and they change different shapes as well. So I wanted to try and reflect that in the poem that was at the start of the novel. So in the course of trying to find the roots of this old oak tree, Richard comes across the skeleton of a hare. There's a beautifully preserved skeleton that he takes back to the house and sort of rearranges on his desk. And as the spring comes to the valley, the hare becomes a symbol of hope to him.
You said it's a book about faith, and there are different kinds of faith, aren't they? I mean, Richard tries to put, as you say, his faith in the practical, and she in this otherworldly kind of notions. And really, neither is satisfying enough for each of their needs.
No, and that's really what I was trying to write about in the novel, really. Grief being this completely bewildering experience, and how we come out of that, how we find a way through it, I think is almost impossible at the time. It's an experience that we maybe apply language to after much much later. When it's happening, I think it's just so confusing. And the word psychosis kept coming to me when I was writing this. It felt like grief is a kind of psychosis, a kind of madness. And I think that any sort of comfort that we can find, we cling on to very strongly. But as you say, it's never that fulfilling, it's never completely satisfactory. And in fact, both Richard and Juliet are kind of clinging on to rather sort of empty symbols in some way. So it provides a sort of temporary relief, but ultimately, It's just more delusion.
The theme of faith extends into the reader's relationship with the book as well, doesn't it? As we are being encouraged to explore our ability to experience a reality conjured up by you and your imagination.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I've been asked a number of times sort of why use the supernatural? Why not just write a book about grief, for example? Why not write a novel about two people getting over the death of their son? But I think that introducing the supernatural just allows you to write about it in a very different way. It maybe allows you to explore the kind of psychology and explore things like madness as well. And the writer Robert Aikman talks about the ghost story connecting with the submerged 9/10 of the consciousness. And I think that in something like grief, which is so kind of introspective and is so kind of embedded in a very deep place, I think it probably needs the supernatural to get to that place.
Well, the name of the book is Starve Acre, and Andrew Michael Hurley is the author, and it's published by John Murray.